15 to 20 minutes afterwards to have a dialogue with all of you about everything we've been talking about today. So.
Morning, everybody. Thanks for being here. The picture up there is a boom crew dragging boom out to fight the Gulf oil spill, and that's going to be one of the things I talk about today. This is about two stories I want to tell you. It's not really, I call them case studies because that's public health parlance, but really I'm just going to tell you what it was like to do this. And one of these is a situation that has been taken care of. The other one is ongoing. And I'll begin. This is a roadmap of what I'd like to cover. And the definition of terms we can probably do real quick. How many people here have done risk communication? How many people have thought about it in some depth? And how many people have done it against the backdrop of a politically charged situation and one in which the science was not really clear? Okay, all right. We can go pretty fast. So we're going to look at cumulative risk a little bit. We've covered that a lot today already. And then look at our two case studies, one of which is about the bringing VX hydrolysate into Port Arthur, Texas. Once again, Port Arthur gets a lot of good things for incineration. And the other one is commuting risk from exposure to crude oil hydrocarbons in the Gulf food web after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Something about lessons learned and something about the benefits of doing collaborative risk characterization. Okay, what is risk? I think you all know that. Just the odds that something's going to happen due to an exposure. I just want you to know where I'm coming from, that's all. The communication, what and why, it's the ways you communicate with your family about levels of health risk and the controls you can adopt to make yourself safer. What is perception? Subjective judgment people make about what's bad and scary and what isn't. Sometimes it's kind of off base. Sometimes it's very clear. And it's most commonly used to refer to natural hazards. Okay, what factors affect risk perception? Knowledge, control, perceived benefit is a very important one, especially if you are working for some facility that is a heavy polluter and you actually get paid to do this, as opposed to just living near it, or you're a fisherman and suddenly for a year you can't fish. But you might be allowed to go out on a vessel of opportunity and work for the responsible party, cleaning things up. So you have to benefit, you know, cost-benefit analyze that. Proximity and duration, and historical experience with risk. And both of the communities I'm going to talk about have great historical experience with exposure to risk and with people coming in to tell them that everything's okay. Here's some of the contextual characteristics that I try and look at when I'm talking to people, and I never really would talk to anybody like this, but this is what I'm looking at in the community, trying, especially getting toward the bottom there, specific special needs and people that don't speak the language I speak. And right now we're working with the Vietnamese community, but there are some much more linguistically isolated communities in our area. Okay, this is just something that I try and work with as kind of touchstones when I'm talking to people. I'd be as transparent as possible, make sure that the audience I'm talking to gets the translation they need, not some kind of cookie cutter or template translation, but what they actually need to understand what's going on, and pledging and actually sustaining engagement as much as is physically possible. Because really just showing up and saying something and never coming back, or coming back a couple of times with the same message when things obviously are not the same, isn't really going to do it. Okay, and these are the general areas people are concerned about when you're communicating risk to them. And they're all pretty, you know, standard, except for the bottom one. Liability issues is a very big thing with our Gulf oil spill. And because the people have been affected in so many different ways by the economic dislocation, they're always wondering how what we say about risk is going to affect their possibility, probability of getting a settlement of some sort. So this is something you have to consider too. And here are some of the differences between the way science looks at risk and the way public approaches risk. And I'm not a scientist at all, so I'm more on the public end of this, and I fully understand that. I had to make myself more aware of the scientific side. And the idea of history is something that science doesn't typically approach when they're talking about risk or characterizing risk, but is very important in a community that historically has been exposed to a lot of different risks. And that's something that part of my job communicating risk is to talk to my scientific colleagues and explain why this is important to the communities that we're working with. And also, when there's controversy, when somebody who has a scientific credible background has a different opinion than another scientist with an equally credible background, the public just looks at that as there are hired guns on both sides, and we will pick the one that we believe, and they pick the ones that they believe. So it's very difficult to get this idea, a conversation about how science happens and how credible science happens as opposed to the other kind with the communities. But this is something we try and do. And what is an environmental justice community? Okay, that's a lot of stuff, but basically it boils down to we have an industrial society and it produces things, effluents, residues, and things of that nature that aren't good for you to be around. Some people have a greater opportunity for exposure to that stuff than others. And EJ communities generally fall into that category. And the other things too, social services, employment, educational opportunities, wholesome food, safe recreation, stuff that a lot of people take for granted, they don't normally find in their community. They don't have that there. And that is all really a portrait of cumulative risk right there. All these different things, like a layer cake. And this is a little diagram of aspects of cumulative risk. And looking at a community in terms of its susceptibility based on what it has to live with already. Its differential exposure. What is their air like as opposed to another community's air on a chronic basis? Differential preparedness. And this has a lot to do with their social determinants of health. And you see the last two boxes there. There are a number of what you would call social determinants of health factors in it. And the ability, of course, to recover from an insult. And we see that in the Gulf a lot. Every time there is a major storm, the communities that are having difficulty in these areas, they recover last and not completely. And they diminish over time. And this is something that has historically been documented. Cumulative risk systematically bridges in EJ, health disparities, and the idea of communicating risk and managing it. It's a way of putting it together that seems to make sense. And the executive order, 128-92, the Clinton administration mandated that environmental justice should be a factor in community engagement in all federal agencies, and that's going to bear on the VX thing considerably. Okay, the two case studies I'm going to talk about, Port Arthur and the Gulf fishing communities, have a lot in common. You look at the commonalities there. Looking at the, and I'm going down to the bottom of commonality, trust issues are huge. Based on historic patterns, on closed hierarchical process, based on appeal to exclusive expertise and or national security, a lot of this comes up in situations in these areas, in risk, and trust is something that's very difficult to build. And a lot of work has to be done to overcome what has already been undone, more or less. And because of issue urgency, risk communication had to commence before the extent of the risk was fully assessed in both of these situations. If you look at the differences, the two communities are way different in size. The duration of the crisis was way different. The science on VX exposure is pretty fully developed. Everybody knows what it is and what it will do. The hydrolysate part of it was something that just had to be explained. The exposure impacts of the petrogenic PAHs from the DWH are unknown still. and the compounds are uncharacterized for toxicity. And I'm saying petrogenic. This is a real sticking point because pyrogenic, not so. But pyrogenic, petrogenic, this is a work in progress. These are hydrocarbons that are part of the crude oil complex. They're not created by combustion. So we're working on that. The primary obstacles to trust in Port Arthur were procedural. This was a lack of engagement and transparency by the Department of Defense. And there were multiple issues in the Gulf situation, the major one being the remediation efforts were managed and supervised by the responsible party, which is an unusual situation, but they do admittedly have the expertise to do it, at least on paper. And the use of a dispersant that nobody knew very much about at the time and still hasn't been really well developed in terms of its human health impacts. And conflicting risk messages, because there were many, many messages going back and forth during that crisis. Okay, case study one is the VX hydrolysate disposal in West Port Arthur. And this is a situation, VX nerve agent in Newport, Indiana, because we signed a chemical weapons convention in 1992. We were supposed to start, it went into force in 97. And from 97 on, we're supposed to be getting rid of this stuff in one way or another. And it was being sent to Port Arthur for ultra-high temperature incineration. There's a RCRA and Tosca certified incinerator there. And risk, the official version, there's no properties of VX nerve agent in hydrolysate. It has a pH of 13.5, so you wouldn't want to spill it on your hand or anything. But they didn't discuss any other caveats. Major points of conflict, there was a business agreement between the DOD and Veolia Environmental Services, which is the company with the incinerator, and the shipments of the denatured VX commenced. The affected DJ community didn't know it was coming at all. In fact, most of the community, and by EJ community in Port Arthur, we're talking about the west side mostly, although the entire community is fairly well impacted by the presence of industry, but nobody knew about it except the mayor and a couple of council people, and it was a business agreement. It was just a business agreement, and there were no opportunities for questions, input, and there was an appeal to national security because after 9-1-1, we want to get rid of this stuff quickly. However, we hadn't got started to get rid of it yet, and we were supposed to start in 1997, so this is something to consider too. What was the action? Port Arthur was informed, and the Community Empower and Development Association, that's the group that Dr. Prochaska was referring to, Hilton Kelly, was informed by the Chemical Weapons Working Group, which actually monitors this stuff, that this stuff was on its way. And they hosted a community meeting and asked us to come in and present some facts on VX and VX hydrolysate, which is easy enough to do, because that all existed. The community formulated talking points and questions for discussion with DOD, and they got an injunction to stop the shipments and had a direct engagement with DOD and Veolia and actually talked about what this stuff was, how it was going to be dealt with, how long it would be stored, things of that nature. And I just want to show you a little bit about Port Arthur, and you've already seen some pictures, but you see the residential and the industrial are literally kissing one another. They're very close together there. There are 12 major refineries there and a number of smaller chemical plants. There are many places that store RCRA exempt and other types of waste, and there are many tank farms. So this place is literally festooned with all of that. This is the friendly skies over the west side quite often. The flaring is a constant event. I mean, not constant, but I mean quite frequent. And once again, just indicating here that to assess the community's risk burden, you have to look at site-specific differences in susceptibility, exposure, preparedness, and ability to recover so that it's accurate and useful to the people that live there. And these are the cumulative risk factors, just a whole laundry list of them that would make Port Arthur an environmental justice community and a community with having a high burden of cumulative risk. And I'm not going to read them to you, but they're all things that we've been talking about today in general. And I included the last one here. It's not really a cumulative risk factor. It's the reason why there was a problem during the VX situation. The people who were involved in the business transaction were completely ignorant of the historical patterns in this community in trying to get their needs addressed. It wasn't really an issue. We were just doing business, and we just happened to be going through the neighborhoods or through the community to do it, and it was not an issue, but it became an issue. So I went down to a very strange meeting at a Baptist church in Port Arthur. There must have been 300 or 400 people around the building, about 150 in the building, and they were all really angry and scared because they didn't know anything about this. They didn't know what VX was. They just knew it was a nerve toxin that killed people very quickly. And actually, it's pretty potent. But that wasn't what was coming, and that was the important thing they needed to know. But I gave them some characteristics of it, and even used the word anticholinesterase, but I explained what it meant. So, I mean, really, people in this situation that don't have a high science literacy, I have found, don't mind that terminology as long as you tell them what it means. Don't just say, there it is. And it's kind of ironic that only U.S. and Russia produced it ever. And it's an organophosphate. And I gave them a brief history of what it was and, you know, how it came into being. And the fact that we entered into an agreement to get rid of all weapons of that nature. Just as we're talking about with Syria right now. Well, we were supposed to be doing this too, and we are. But it takes a long time and has to be done carefully. And I talked about when they started destroying the agent in 04, a little picture of what they're actually being stored in. And what is hydrolysate? It's highly corrosive, pH of 13.5. It's a product of the neutralization process. And the next thing is very important. It's cleared for shipment only if it tests at 20 parts per billion or less residual VX in the solution and 5 parts per million or less of EA2192, which is a byproduct. It's also a nerve toxin, but not nearly as lethal as VX. And explain how they make it, cooking it with sodium hydroxide in very, very hot water. And this is what the community came up with as a result of this meeting, a series of questions. And part of this was input from the Chemical Weapons Working Group. Part of it was, you know, the explanation of what they were actually dealing with that we brought them. And the first thing, though, was the big ask. They want the DOD, the city and the county, and Veolia to come to the table with the community to discuss the safety parameters. And they got the injunction to do that. And then they asked these questions about making the hydrolysate, because there was another way they could have done it, which would involve on-site, it would have been no shipping. And in a sense, if you're worried about terrorism, that's actually better, because during the shipping process, when you're going all the way from Indiana to the Gulf of Mexico, maybe you don't have to do that. That's called supercritical water on site. That would be the other preparation method. But because Veolia had this facility and they were willing to do it, and there didn't appear to be any procedural problems, any hoops to jump through, just do the business, they sent it there because they wanted it done quickly. And so these questions were all eventually addressed during the sit-down meeting. The injunction was lifted and it rolled on through. And it's done now. It's all finished. But this was a successful risk communication situation because everybody came out of it feeling that they got what they needed to know feel that the safest thing was being done to safeguard their communities, safeguard their families. And the one thing, though, that didn't get addressed, and this is something that an EJ community is particularly susceptible to, is becoming known as the go-to place for stuff nobody wants, because there were communities in Ohio and New Jersey who said no, okay, and they had an incinerator too. Well, this community said yes, and Mr. Kelly was always concerned about that. We don't want to be known as the sump of the United States. And I'm not so sure that that one was effectively addressed. But okay, case study two, human health risk from exposure to petrogenic PAHs. There's a situation which you've certainly read about. The risk, okay, the NRDC critiqued the official FDA risk at the beginning of the crisis. Their new risk was based on factoring in vulnerable categories of possible consumers of seafood, which the FDA didn't do. And that caused a lot of cognitive dissonance. Major points of conflict, lack of community trust. Backdrop of ongoing NERDA and criminal civil litigation involving responsible parties who were also in charge of cleaning it up and counting the oil. Oh, well, we'll get that done in 2 minutes. Okay. And action. Well, we're doing a testing study right now, and I'll get on to that. This is the name of the study. This is these are the goals of the study. We're looking at PAHs, but of the petrogenic variety. These are the risk factors, the cumulative risk factors that contribute to the vulnerability in these communities. As you can see, there are tons of them. And climate change, down at the bottom, you could apply that to Port Arthur as well. It's on the Gulf, too. Sea level rise and subsidence is really a big issue in southern Louisiana. All these storms that have happened, there's five of them right there, but tropical storms are actually pretty destructive, too, there, because the wetlands are really not what they used to be, and they were the dampening effect. They used to cut the wind. They don't do it anymore. And general access to health care in these states is very limited. Okay, just to give you an idea of the exposure to oil hydrocarbons that are your potential opportunities, this happened after Katrina. This is Plaquemines Parish, basically, and these are all places where there were major spills or leaks. The one you probably heard about is the one at the very top, Chalmette Murphy. The city of Chalmette, a large swath of neighborhood was literally inundated by oil there, and hasn't really come back yet, not that part of it. And this is the density of oil and gas exploration and production facilities in this area, and those little dots in the water are offshore rigs. And this is where, and this is, you know, going back in history, this is from June 2010. This is where oil had made landfall at that point. And actually, if I, you know, we could fast forward that, you'd see more landfall in different areas. And this is the dissonance that happened because of the revisions in the amount of flow. This happened over and over again as they got more and more precise with measuring it until it got to perhaps 20,000 to 65,000 barrels per day as opposed to the original 1,000. And that, you know, people were concerned about that. So we have a sampling network based of these in these four organizations, United Home and Nation, Mississippi Coalition of Vietnamese American Fisher Folk and Families, South Bay Communities Alliance, and I should say / Alabama Fisheries Cooperative. It's since merged into that. And the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. This is where we have sampled. We have 171 discrete sites so far, and they're divided into three organizations. We have some blank areas because people aren't fishing there anymore much. You notice Plaquemines Parish is one of them. That's where all those oil spills after Katrina were. Well, that area has taken the biggest hit from storms and the oil spill in general. This is the way we worked with the fishing communities. Our community hub organizations recruited fishermen. Lean, under the guidance of Wilma Subra, developed protocols for doing sampling that were EPA validated. We sampled and the fishermen sampled and they processed, prepared, and shipped or prepared for shipment the samples and we picked them up. And then we had fishermen's forums. We go back to the fishing community to talk about what we found. And it's iterative because it just keeps going on and on and on as we get closer to knowing what to say about the actual risk from petrogenic PAHs. And we have to recruit new fishermen a lot too, because this is a lot of work. It interrupts their day. And some of them will do it over and over again. Some of them just want to do it once. And here is Wilma Subra, the Lean Science Consultant and MacArthur Award winner. You need to know that. Talking to some fishermen in Raceland, Louisiana about how to do this. And here is another way in which we're getting the information out to the public. Lean has a website, a very good one, and this is a vetted process where all the hubs and all the scientists get together, talk about what can we actually say right now that doesn't go too far, because the science isn't ready to say that yet, and doesn't say not enough, because the community needs to know more. It's a very clunky process, because there's a lot of us, and everybody has their own agenda, but we have managed to get three things on the web. We're working on our fourth one, and tune into this website if you want to know about what's going on. Okay, lessons we're still learning. The last one is the most important one for me, working deliberately with precision and care against the backdrop of urgency and uncertainty. This is something, it's been a real learning experience for our bench scientists. They've never done this before. This is not something they're supposed to do. But they have to make sure that they can come up with information we can take to communities that is timely. And timeliness and scientific credibility sometimes are hard to put together. The rest of it, what CBPR means too, what science owes the community while they're working in that context, what rules must be followed to maintain data integrity, and how to collaboratively manage information flow. Really hard to do, and especially spread out over three states. And this is the reason for doing it, as far as I'm concerned. This is the last slide. These are the things that you get out of doing this kind of collaborative risk characterization with community groups. It expands your research, the parameters of your research, because you're getting information you never would have gotten otherwise. Procedural democracy is important in a situation like this, especially where people felt very disempowered by what happened. Increasing the capacity to do research, we could not even remotely approach this project without these community groups, because we don't know these people at all, as the fishermen especially. They don't have anything to do with science normally. So this was an important leverage capacity building element. And the last one, equity. Is it's very, really important that not what level of risk is acceptable, but who's getting hurt by this, and what do they need? How do they get themselves out of this situation? You got to consider that. That's got to be a very important consideration in what you're doing. And acknowledgments. And that's the totemic animal of the Seeley Center for Environmental Health and Medicine, the brown pelican. I like to end with that every time.
Everybody back up, and hopefully we have a few minutes left for questions and just a general discussion. Yes, sir.
So I'm Leslie Latin from the University of California. I found all the really interesting. The thing that struck me was to really search into the question of evidence, what constitutes evidence. I wondered, I have two questions. One is, next you spoke about the alliance building, the coalition building, and how you got people. Comfortable with the evidence. I think that they
agreed with the report and the way that we, the draft that we were able to develop, admittedly based on lots of comments from them, because we were engaged in a process that they had confidence in. I think because we really tried to be responsive to the concerns that they were raising and not just say, oh yeah, it's a real political issue, gosh, you know, let's see what happens. But we actually took it seriously and went back and, you know, so a year and a half later, we're still working on it, yes, but we've got something that's going to last a heck of a lot longer than this project now that we weren't expecting. I think that it was the process that they began to trust in working with us on that. Did it strengthen the most vulnerable? I think it did in the sense that in a little bit of an indirect way, in the sense that the representatives on the Community Steering Committee were not members of public housing or potential public housing residents. They were representatives of advocacy groups along with a number of other people on the steering committee. I think it gave them a way to talk about issues at times that they didn't have a public platform for talking about issues, and brought some broader understanding of what it was they were trying to do and their perspective. I think that the work itself, if we can actually implement it, you know, that's a whole other process, right? Because this is just research, you know, if it goes on the shelf, it hasn't done anything for anybody. But if we are able to continue to engage in the planning process, then certainly the interests of the former public housing residents that were displaced and, you know, continue to, you know, not have very sustainable housing conditions will have been, certainly have been strengthened. We have a real challenge right now, I think, in Texas in a broader sense in terms of political voice and balance of political voice in public dialogue that I don't think that this kind of a project can necessarily realistically aim to overcome, but in the sense that we're trying to enlarge a local understanding of the public good and community development as a mechanism for all kinds of wonderful things that people might want, whether it's economic development or healthier folks or less crime or whatever, I think we are accomplishing that.
Yes.
I was interested in your attention to the contributions or the assets of education, the pre-K to 12 resources, whether they're private or public, the quality of the education offered. Have you factored those into your assessment?
Oh, yes. One of the challenges that we have, though, particularly at Galveston, is Galveston recently went to a schools of choice model. So where many assessments look at proximity to the nearest elementary school, we're having to adjust our weights based on, you know, the fact that while there may be an elementary school across the street, a family may be sending their child to an elementary school several miles away. That being said, we still keep quality or equality and proximity in the model. It just the weights are adjusted to compensate for the difference.
Is it too complex to actually measure differences among different school resources?
I don't know about complex, but the answer is yes. The challenge we're having is, at least in Texas, it's hard to get school level quality data. We can get it at the district level, and Galveston is just one school district. So trying to tease apart the different aspects.
Congratulations to all three of you for great work as well as great presentation.
Yeah. Just to add on to what you were commenting about, obviously early child development is a really critical piece of the puzzle, not only for the contributions it makes to child health, but what it does for families in terms of allowing people to attain better, to have jobs and to have more independence. But, you know, what is it? The GIS mapping of actually just looking at kind of the location and this kind of physical world that we live in really does raise questions of quality and true availability, because a lot of times the data sources that you're tapping into aren't really very accurate. And so the idea that a daycare is licensed to have 80 kids, but if you put 80 children in that daycare, that would be a disaster. Or the fact that quality measures aren't really very high standards. And to do any of that kind of incorporation into the assessment, you really have to do a huge amount of primary data collection. And in fact, we partnered with another organization, the Austin, to do that, and now have the results of that, and it shows a much bigger demand for need for early child development for daycares, especially for infants, that anybody in the city has realized is, you know, is emerging as a kind of critical piece of the development of the local life.
Another huge piece of information that might be interesting is what happens after pre-K. We lose so many children apparently in the middle years, and then the dropout rate is huge, and
yes.
Leading on to crime and into the great prison industry that exists in Texas and elsewhere.
Texas is quite a pioneer.
It is.
In the back.
Another question for John. I was wondering your comment about the experience people were having with the sensation of being the sump of the U.S. What learning went on in the community from the VX experience that impacted current and future work on that problem?
That's a difficult problem for a community organization like SEDA to address, because you can't really enlist too many allies from, say, the commercial or business sector to address it also, unless you can convince them that it's generally not good for the community and we want to take it in a different direction to have it known for that kind of thing. Right now, that community isn't at that point. They've just gone through their two-year period of being the EJ Showcase community in Region 6, which was kind of like, according, you know, for the mayor, it was like getting a booby prize. It didn't mean you were a caravan. It meant you were a problem child. And so we had to work on it. And they went through that process, and they developed a plan that more or less diversified what they want to do in the future. And CETA was part of that, because they had to be included. And that was a real interesting thing to watch, too. A group that had never been given access to city council or anything like that, in any formal way, suddenly is now at the table with them. And people that had not really been educated in those things, like city planning or emergency preparedness or things of that nature, are now sitting down and discussing that with people who did that for a living. And it did affect things, and I don't have it in front of me or anything, but they did publish a plan, and the plan did have more for the economic prospects of Port Arthur than just additional refineries. But, as Dr. Prochaska pointed out, the Shell Motiva plant is going to be the largest refinery in the United States by the time they tool out for the Keystone pipeline. We're going to be getting that oil in Port Arthur and in Houston. And so it's, I don't know. I don't know how that's going to actually work out, because if they're committed to that by inertia, I mean, you know, they've got all that stuff, it's not going to go away. But they do say on paper that they would like to see other kinds of things.
I agree. It's when it reminds me of back in school, the saying, I was at a school of rural public health, and the saying was, when you've seen one rural community, you've seen one rural community. Each one of these communities are very nuanced. It's going to be one heck of a challenge trying to identify, you know, what an EJ community is and trying to find them all. I think what we may be able to better predict are areas that are vulnerable to being faced with environmental injustice, but whether or not they are actual environmental justice communities, I don't know if we're going to be able to do that quantitatively without actually going to each one of these sites, engaging with the community, and getting their inputs on their feelings in their community.
Something like the pipeline, it has such a momentum behind it already, even though it appears that everybody that I know in the EJ world in Texas pretty much assumes that no matter how hard they fight, it's probably going to go through. And it's not, you know, it's not good for the airshed, we know that. It's going to change the quality of the, you know, ambient air in many places. There's so much at stake economically, though. And even though the government hasn't made up its mind yet, I don't think anybody is very optimistic about it. I'm not answering your question.
And we don't have a broad political space for evidence-based discussion about issues in our state. And that makes it very difficult to figure out strategies for, okay, great, you built a coalition. What are you going to do with it? You know, if people don't feel empowered to stand up and say something publicly, you have a longer path ahead of you. So. But as far as the development, the further development of the cumulative risk workforce center, yeah, I mean, we hope to continue to develop it. We hope to find ways to make it useful as tools for other kinds of groups. And one of the things that we really try to do with our work in our center is to develop models, but to develop models for application, to do, you know, action research that's also locally relevant so that we are making a local contribution.
One last question I think we have time for.
Hi, Greg Slade from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Thank you so much for the presentation and the work. I'm curious about how racism is explicitly discussed, if it's discussed, and if it is, if then if you have requests from the community to include racism as a measure in the health impact assessments, and how you approach that.
Thanks for cutting that one to me. It is an implicit issue in almost every discussion that we have in the state about how to promote health within communities. It's like this kind of background conversation about racism. Is this an aspect of racism that we're seeing, or is it something else that's just manifesting that it looks like racism? I mean, there's actually been a lot of efforts to try to raise the issue of racism across the United States, particularly also in Texas lately. We are hoping to do some anti-racism training in Galveston, but it's framed as historical institutional racism and understanding how processes of racism are replicated. The woman that's been directing that program for doing this work. So it's tricky sometimes to figure out how you bring the issue up without necessarily putting yourself in the line of fire. If, for instance, if you're an academician and one person can bring a conflict of interest charge or some kind of unprofessionalism charge against you and it literally threatens your job, it becomes much more difficult. So I think that's part of the reason why we have to strengthen the work with community leadership so that they are able to articulate ideas and identify in moments when race is a really relevant issue to talk about. I mean, there have been lots of charges of racism in the local context of recovering public housing. Of course, you know, the response is this isn't about racism, this is about people being independent, and, you know, da-da-da-da. But disentangling that, and I mean, maybe it's a, you know, maybe John and I should talk about a communication issue, but how to basically talk with the community in a way that is a constructive dialogue, I think is something that we really need to force resources into. It's really, really needed.
Going all the way back to Robert Miller's book, Delphine and Dixie, and the work he did right in Houston, and 87% your chances of better, 87% more of living next to something that you wouldn't want to be living next to if you were black or if you were Latino. I mean, it hasn't really changed tremendously since then. And the communities, of course, they understand what's going on. We did a forum theater project with Hilton's group in 2004. And they did a show about trying to go to the city and talk to them about releases that were happening all the time, you know, bad flaring incidents or just releases. And the guy who was the gatekeeper just kept saying, you people, and use that term all the time, that means something to them. They get it a lot, and it's obvious to them, but they can't bring it up. It's something, it's there, you know, right in front of everybody, but it's not a fit topic for discussion, so to speak.
All right, well, I want to thank everybody for your time and for coming to the